Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. I've been talking about LearnTrue, T-R-U-E, history.com. You've heard about it several times in the introduction of this podcast. So get on out to LearnTrueHistory.com to get history the way it was intended to be told, with no PC, no Marxism, no progressivism. But not only that, I've got my new How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, my forthcoming book. So I want you to go to LearnTrueHistory.com to sign up for that great program. But also, if you go to blamehamilton.com, you can get in on some giveaways for my forthcoming book. So two websites for you: learntruehistory.com and blamehamilton.com. Get in on both of those things. Learntruehistory.com is the place to go to learn history the way it was intended to be told. Blamehamilton.com is where you learn about how Alexander Hamilton was the greatest villain in American history. This is the Brian McClanahan Show. 3, 2, 1, 0. Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. This is episode 92. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, just want to remind you that if you like this podcast, please share it around on social media with all your friends and enemies alike. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, at Brian McClanahan. You can follow me on Twitter, again, at Brian McClanahan, and you can like my YouTube page. Just go on out there and search for Brian McClanahan as well. And if you go to brianmcclanahan.com and you give me an email address, I'll give you a free ebook, Forgotten Founders in American History, and also a free audiobook read by yours truly, of the same title, Forgotten Founders in American History. And I just want to remind you, I know you've got the introduction to this podcast talking about my great giveaway promotion that I'm doing right now for my forthcoming How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. Really excited about this. It actually goes to press in just about a week from now, maybe 2 weeks. And so we're getting ready to go over the final proofs. It looks great. But if you go out to blamehamilton.com, and you click on the button there and you follow the proper procedures for getting your giveaways. If you pre-order one book and you give me a screenshot of that, I'll send you a free ebook, the Jeffersonian Solution. And also, if you pre-order two or more books, not only will you get the free ebook, the Jeffersonian Solution, I'll also send you a 6-lecture course on Alexander Hamilton. So all you got to do is go out to blamehamilton.com and do that. And if you do like this podcast and you want to help keep the lights on, help keep it going, you can contribute to little or as much as you would like. I appreciate all contributions, but you can go to brianmcclanahan.com/support, and you can click the little button there to donate to the Brian McClanahan Show. So I'd appreciate anything you want to give. If it's 1 cent, I'll take it. If that's all you think the podcast is worth, God bless you, because that's great. That'll help keep the lights on, help keep the podcast going. Okay, so today I want to talk about the idea of nullification. Now, if you are a fan of this show, of course, you probably already listened to the Tom Woods Show, and you've probably seen his book, Nullification. Maybe you're someone who follows the 10th Amendment Center, which their whole premise is built on nullification, state acts that can knock down federal power. And for a long time, this entire idea was seen as somehow crazy. I remember back in the mid-90s, actually, it's more like 1998, late 90s, when I was a graduate student. And I was having a conversation with my advisor, Clyde Wilson, and another individual. And we were talking about ideas on how to beat back federal power. And of course, I was just a graduate student. I didn't know anything. But I said, you know, maybe something we need to consider is nullification. And this other individual looked at me and said, that's crazy. That'll never work. It's never worked in history. And I remember Clyde Wilson turning and saying, no, anytime it's been tried, it's worked. And of course, this was before the 10th Amendment Center was around. And in the 1990s, some of these ideas started fermenting, so to speak, in the American polity. But in the 1990s, you couldn't really get away with saying much of this stuff. And it's amazing to me that here we are in 2017, and a decade later, you've got the founding of the 10th Amendment Center. And of course, the 10th Amendment Center has quite a bit of traction. And of course, in 2002, you had the founding of the Abbeville Institute, which talks about the Jeffersonian political tradition. And that has done a great service to getting people to think about this idea of nullification. But at the heart of nullification, so I'm going to give you a little history of nullification, and I'm also going to talk about one of the important parts of nullification that's often missed. At the heart of nullification is the idea that came out of the Enlightenment in many ways, and also came out of, you know, the Western political tradition, but it's the idea of consent. Now, you can't really go back to the classical republics, even Rome or Greece. You can't really look at these places and say, well, those governments were based on the conception of consent. But as you move forward into the British political experience, or the English political experience, it's a wonderful thing that the United States political tradition was founded on that particular element of political philosophy. Because the British really did, or the English people, came up with this idea of government by the consent of the governed. And so when you go back and you look at, for example, the Magna Charta, and the fact that these barons at Runnymede forced King John Lackland to sign the Magna Carta and saying the king is not above the law. Essentially, the law is greater than the king. And not only that, there is a form of consent in this government. These barons did not consent to the king abusing his power. And so that particular type of tradition where you started having this whole idea formulated of consent, the consent of the governed. Of course, the French talked about this, but the English, I think, did it better. There has to be consent. And so when you look at the Declaration, for example, Jefferson talks about consent. And so how is consent measured? Of course, this is something we could actually have an entire course on. How do we measure consent in a polity? How do we measure consent among a political group of people? Is consent, if you're just born in a system, do you consent to that system then, just because you live in it? Is that consent? You would have some very ardent libertarians say, well, no, that I have to consent for them to tax me or, take my stuff, my property. I'm not consenting to that, so therefore that government is not really my government. And so that's an anarchist position in a lot of ways. But this whole idea of consent. Now, we do consent. I mean, how do we measure consent? Well, I mean, some would say, well, if you vote, you consent to the government. So a lot of people will say, well, we just won't vote. That takes away our consent. If you pay taxes, you consent to the government. Well, so I just won't pay taxes. Of course, the threat is if you don't pay taxes, you go to jail. And so people will pay taxes to stay out of jail, and that's a wise thing to do. You can't do much in jail. So we have to think of a way to measure consent. Well, the problem with this whole concept of consent is that I think Americans have forgotten this particular idea over time. And so even in our daily lives, we often don't consent to things we don't like. Now, this is the think locally, act locally position that I've often articulated. But, you know, if you don't consent to, say, mainstream elements of mainstream popular culture, you just don't view that material. You don't participate in that material. You don't do that. You're withdrawing your consent. If you don't consent to the public education system, you send your kids to private school, or you homeschool, or you do something of that nature, you don't consent to the system. And so you're withdrawing your consent. If you get out of the rat race of debt and finance in terms of borrowing money, if you get out of that rat race and you're so financially independent that you don't need anything else, well, then you don't consent to the modern financial system. You remove your consent. You withdraw that consent. So in so many ways, you can withdraw your consent in various elements outside of political consent. But even in that, a lot of people don't realize that consent is still at the heart of any type of legislation. For example, many states, many cities, I should say, have laws on the books that would prohibit you by law from spitting on the sidewalk. Now, we could say that spitting on the sidewalk is disgusting and we shouldn't do that. But no one's going to go arrest you for spitting on the sidewalk. Now, they could. The police could come up, they could see you spit on the sidewalk, and they could put you in handcuffs and put you in the back of the cruiser and take you downtown and book you. Of course, I know that's kind of 1950s. Take them downtown and book them. Well, they could. They could take you to the police station. They could book you and give you a fine for spitting on the sidewalk, write you a ticket, whatever it is, depending on the severity of the penalty. We know there are signs up that say, don't litter, but people throw stuff on the side of the road all the time, and now they're not caught, but a lot of times it's just because no one feels like enforcing that law. People break the speed limit all the time. They drive over the speed limit, and not everyone's caught, so you're not really consenting to that law of a speed limit. The threat of penalty keeps people driving at a certain speed, or the wise people think, well, going too fast is dangerous, so I'm not going to do that. Those that drive without a seatbelt don't consent to that law. Now, it's wise to drive with a seatbelt because it could save your life. But some people choose not to do it, and so therefore they're not consenting to the law. Now, there is a penalty to that. If you get caught and you're not wearing your seatbelt, well, you're going to get a fine. If you get caught speeding, you're going to get a fine. So those laws are enforced, but there are many laws that aren't enforced. The law enforcement officials just refuse to enforce them. And therefore, that essentially nullifies the law. So let's take that position a little further and go back into the American political experience and then talk about nullification in that way. So if we start looking at nullification, where we find the origins of it in the American experience, there is an entire period of American history called the era of salutary neglect. This is a period where the laws of Great Britain were rarely enforced in the colonies. Essentially, those laws were null and void because they were not enforced. And typically this was trade laws and tax laws. They just weren't enforced very well. You had the Navigation Acts, which the British Parliament passed, which were not enforced, rigidly enforced in the colonies. So the colonial governments got around a lot of these things, and they started acting very independently. And I've talked about on this podcast just a couple of episodes ago, the constitutional crisis of 1776, and how this whole idea of federalism was really born in this American colonial experience, that these colonies were essentially independent political entities that the British Parliament could not control. And so as that developed, you essentially had a nullification position among the American colonies because they just refused to enforce the laws. There was no consent. They did not consent to those laws, and so therefore they were not enforced in the British North American colonies. And we find in 1754, as Benjamin Franklin proposed what was called the Albany Plan of Union, that this particular idea was not well received in the colonies. And why was that? Well, Franklin made it very clear why that was, because, in his words, the colonies were narrowly provincial in their outlook, meaning that they didn't want any other central authority telling them what to do. They wanted the authority to control their own destiny in their own colonies. And why was that? Well, it's because these governments in the colonies were closer to the people, and therefore, if any central authority passed legislation, even in the colony itself, that was deemed to be unconstitutional, it was just not enforced. And there are some examples of this. In Virginia, if the government in Richmond passed a law that was deemed unjust or unconstitutional in other parts of the colony of Virginia, well, the courts would just refuse to enforce that particular law. The law enforcement officials, the sheriffs, the county sheriffs, would just not arrest people for it. So, in essence, these county governments acted as a hedge against the colonial government. This is what the states were designed to do in regard to the central government. And so when Patrick Henry stood up in 1765 during the Stamp Act crisis and essentially threatened that Virginia was already independent of Great Britain, he was stating a point that had already been essentially put into play in fact in the Virginia colony. Virginia, in so many ways, was already independent of the British Empire because it essentially operated on its own. It had its own laws, had its own currency, had its own legal, had its own taxing system. It had all of these things. It didn't need the Parliament to tell it what to do. It didn't need the Parliament to govern them in all cases whatsoever, which is what the Parliament thought they could do. So the counties could act as a hedge against the House of Burgesses, and the colony of Virginia could act as a hedge against the government in London, the Parliament. And it wasn't just Virginia that had that position. You find this quite frequently in New England, particularly, again, during the Stamp Act crisis. If you want to read a very good book on this, it's by there is a book by a man named Edmund Morgan, and it's published in the 1950s, and it's entitled The Stamp Act Crisis. And he actually has a chapter in that book entitled Nullification. Lo and behold, here we are talking about 1765, and we're already discussing nullification. So we had the Albany Plan of Union 1754, and then 1765, you have this idea of nullification dusted off. In Rhode Island, for example, the Rhode Island legislature had already protected all of its judges who would find people not guilty for violating the Stamp Act. They would not be fined in the colony of Rhode Island. And this was the case in other colonies as well. So when you look at the act of nullification outside of that, other colonies were trying to ensure that through shipping, they could prevent the Stamp Act from being enforced. They would hide things. They would smuggle things. They would also ensure that all the paper products they could have would be out before they could be stamped. They would do all kinds of things to ensure that people did not consent to the law. That was the key. They withdrew their consent. That was the whole idea of non-importation that the colonial leaders dusted off over and over again. Well, we're just not consent to your tax. We're just not going to buy your stuff. We refuse to consent. That is personal nullification. So it doesn't have to be a direct act of a political body like a legislature or a convention. It can just be an individual act or an act of a group of people. That essentially is nullification. So we need to think about nullification in a broader concept. How can you withdraw your consent from an illegal or unconstitutional or unjust act? You just refuse to do whatever that act or law says. Now, again, if you're going to go to jail, then you have to make a decision. Is it worth it? Do I want to have to go through the legal process? Now, of course, you can use this what's called jury nullification. The jury can nullify a law and say that, well, that law is just unjust. We're not going to find the person guilty of violating that law because that law is unjust. That can happen too. There's all kinds of different ways these things can happen. But as we move forward and we start talking about political nullification, we get to the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798. Now, if you listen to the common interpretation of this, Jefferson and Madison fabricated this out of thin air. They just made this up. This is what the left will tell you. Well, I should say the nationalists on the left, or the nationalists on the right. Those who are interested in real federalism on the left understand that this is actually a just concept. But they didn't fabricate this out of thin air. This was built on, number one, colonial experience in the time leading up to the American War for Independence, and number two, on their understanding of the ratification of the Constitution, which if you read my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution, I talk about this in the book. In fact, you can get that book. Every now and then somebody comes across this and they're surprised about it. I'm going to tell you, if you go to Barnes & Noble, your Barnes & Noble might have that book for about $8 or $9. It's selling like wildfire out there for like $8 or $9. Go to your Barnes & Noble. If they don't have it there, ask for it. It's in the bargain book area. And they have it all the time. It's not a remainder, but this is an actual book they run in their bargain book section now. So you can get the Founding Fathers Guide to the Constitution for about $9. It is a steal of a deal. So go on out there and look for it. I have a chapter, several chapters on this idea of what, in fact, the whole book is based on the ratification principle, what the ratifier said about the Constitution. But I talk about this idea of nullification and how several of the founding members of the founding generation said, even Alexander Hamilton, if a law was not made in pursuance of the Constitution, then it's null and void. And so they're already recognizing that nullification and some type of nullification would have to take place. Even if the Supreme Court declares a law unconstitutional, it's nullifying a law. So there is some type of recourse. This whole idea of nullification, Americans believe in it. They just have a hard time making the final step to saying, well, the states, the people of the states can do these things, or individuals can do these things. We just think the Supreme Court is the only entity that can do these things, and that's just completely preposterous. The Supreme Court is not the be-all, end-all of consent. And so when you look at the founding generation and you look at these ratification debates, this idea of how unconstitutional laws would be opposed, essentially they're talking about nullification here. So when Jefferson and Madison wrote the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions in 1798, they were simply expressing what had been said before many other times in American history to that point. They were stating the compact fact of the Constitution. That's something else that we have to ensure that we say, and I know I've said it on this podcast before, and I've said it in many different talks, but it is a compact fact, not a compact theory of government. Theory is giving the other side too much credit. There's no theory, it's a fact. The Constitution is a compact between the states so ratifying the same, as Article 7 clearly says. And it's not a compact between people or individuals. It's not... As Hamilton, again, blame Hamilton, hashtag blame Hamilton, or Marshall or Story suggested. The second half of that book is all about bashing Marshall and Story and Hugo Black. So that's great. I mean, that's, to me, in so many ways, that is some part of the book that's much more fun than even the first half of the book. But Hamilton is so popular, you got to bash him first. So Jefferson and Madison articulate this position, and actually, as it's been discovered, that they weren't alone. There were other states that were willing to come to their aid. They'd been long considered that no one else agreed with Jefferson and Madison, or Virginia and Kentucky in this particular case, and that's just simply not true. There's been evidence that other states would have sided with them if it had gone a little further. Now, moving forward, do we find nullification again after 1798? Well, absolutely. You find it all the time. You find secession discussed quite openly in 1794 by the North. You find it again in 1801. You find it again in 1803. But nullification in a way that we would somewhat recognize it takes place during the Hartford Convention of 1815. Now, what's interesting about that, first of all, Daniel Webster was a participant in the Hartford Convention. Daniel Webster also advocated nullification early on in the War of 1812. He made a speech in 1812, and I've had a podcast on Daniel Webster. He made a speech in 1812 where he essentially said that I believe that Massachusetts should nullify federal laws. And he was a participant at the Hartford Convention, and the Hartford Convention recommended a series of constitutional amendments which would have cut the power of the South. One thing you can say about the North, and I think this is completely true, is that they were never really interested in nationalism, meaning the Union for the whole. They were always interested in their own sectional well-being. If nullification and secession would work that way, they were great with that. If it didn't, they were all in favor of a strong central authority. The South was always more interested in a real Union rather than the North. And I think that that's very clear as you look at the record. But Webster was advocating nullification during that particular period of time. And then, of course, 15 years later, when you get to the Tariff of Abominations of 1828, and then the Webster-Hayne debate of 1830, and then the Webster-Calhoun debate, you find that Daniel Webster has somehow reversed course. He's gone 180 degrees the other direction, and now he's against nullification because these South Carolinians are for it. But, of course, we had nullification there. Now, oftentimes, people would say, well, yeah, here we got Calhoun, he's saying nullification, but when they asked James Madison about this, he said, that's not, oh, no, I don't agree with nullification. Well, you have to understand Calhoun's position. And we can argue about whether Calhoun's position was accurate, but Calhoun essentially said that one state could nullify a law for all the Union. And James Madison said, no, that's not what we were saying. We weren't nullifying the law for the entire Union. We were essentially saying this law is not going to be enforced within the borders of Virginia, and there was some discussion about having a larger discussion among the states in regard to that. But one state couldn't just knock it out for the whole Union. And that was Calhoun's position. That was not Madison and Jefferson's position. So there is a difference of opinion there, but Madison did not backtrack from nullification entirely. And so I think it's very clear to, we have to make that very clear, because when people say, yeah, well, Madison wrote the Virginia Resolves, but then he rejected nullification when Calhoun brought it up. Well, there's a nuance to that that you have to understand. So South Carolina, of course, is pushing nullification, and they were doing it in the right way, by the way. And if you're looking at a political action, it was through a convention of the people of South Carolina. They called a convention, they nullified the tariff of 1832, and then they nullified the force bill after that was passed and rescinded their ordinance of nullification for the tariff. And I think that's the forgotten history of nullification, too. They continued nullifying. And then, of course, we see nullification when we get to the 1840s and into the 1850s with the North with personal liberty laws. And there is a little difference here. Now, you can say the thing about the personal liberty laws, and of course, nowadays we would agree with that. We don't want anyone enslaved. But at the time, we have to remember that the fugitive slave law was actually in the Constitution itself. So this is a different take on nullification. This was a moral position on nullification, saying that the fugitive slave law is immoral. Was it illegal or unconstitutional? No. It was not illegal or unconstitutional in the 1840s and 1850s. And so the South actually did have a valid complaint constitutionally in the 1840s and 1850s in saying that these personal liberty laws were unconstitutional. Now, we could argue that they were moral, but when you're looking at a legal document, you say, okay, this is the contract that we have among the states, and you've agreed to this, and so therefore, you have to do it. Now, this gets into the idea of consent again. These people just didn't consent. They didn't consent to that law. So do they have to consent to something that wasn't ratified in their lifetime? Well, the founding generation would have a response for that. In fact, Nathaniel Macon, when the idea of nullification was brought up, he said, that's stupid. You don't nullify, you just secede. In this particular case, these states that had personal liberty laws, he would just suggest to them, well, secede, get out of the union. If you don't like the union as formed, if you don't consent to that, then leave. And so you do have that argument that you have to contend with. Nullification is a first step towards independence. Because in reality, if you don't consent, then you should withdraw and not still try to be part of something. That was the whole point of independence. And as you see, as the colonies resisted and they withdrew their consent over time, and then it got to the point in 1776 where they decided they had to essentially withdraw. They had to get out of the Union because the British were not going to try to keep enforcing their laws, and the colonies withdrew their consent. And so this is the key to nullification. Now, of course, nullification then had a stain to it because of the civil rights movement, because of the fact that the states in the South, and not just in the South, you had places like Kansas, but these states had a social system that many people considered to be immoral. And so when the pressure was put on the Southern states to reform that social system, they withdrew to the idea of interposition or nullification. And so that also has this stigma to it. Well, I mean, nullification, people are talking about this. They don't remember the civil rights and what happened. Well, I think that in this particular case, people do remember that. And they do remember the history of nullification. I don't think anyone who's in favor of nullification doesn't know these things. And that, yes, nullification has been used for particular cause. Now, it was never used in favor of slavery, ever. Ever. It was always used against slavery, and then, of course, it was used during the Civil Rights Movement, but only to a degree. They did try to stop this federal legislation from being enforced, and, of course, there's a consent issue there. The white South was not consenting. Black Southerners were consenting. And so, you know, then you have that political conflict. This becomes a political question. It has to be hashed out that way. But this all comes back to this notion of consent. What do you consent to? What do you not consent to? What is a moral law or unconstitutional or unjust law? These are things that a polity has to deal with. And so everyone in their own way believes in nullification. If nobody believed in nullification, then people wouldn't drive over the speed limit. People would write you a ticket every time you spit on the sidewalk in a city where that's the law. You would not have these things going on in society. You would not have law enforcement officers or officials look the other way under certain conditions. They just wouldn't. But that essentially is nullification. The people don't consent. And then, of course, you take that on a broader scale, and now you start talking about what can political entities do. Well, I would always recommend conventions. I made a talk about a year ago now, a year ago in August, about this particular idea. What can you have? How do you do these things? And, of course, you have to look at conventions. It is the voice of the people. everything major that's really ever been done in American history worthwhile has been done through a convention. Essentially, you could even say that the Continental Congresses were conventions. There were delegates sent from these colonies to represent those colonies. They were ambassadors of those colonies. This was convention. The Philadelphia Convention. The idea that the Constitution was ratified through convention. All of these things. You had other conventions that were important. Constitutions are written and ratified in conventions, even state constitutions. So you can have the convention process for amending the Constitution. And in fact, you could tear down the entire structure. You could start over. You could abolish the Union through convention. Because conventions are the voice of the people. Of the people, by the people, and for the people. And when you talk about consent, that's what you get into. So you can have personal nullification. You can say, I'm not going to consent to the school system. I'm not going to consent to this particular, whatever issue it is. I'm not going to do that. You can have political nullification where a body, a legislative body or a group of people through convention decide they're going to say that law is unconstitutional, immoral, or unjust, whatever the case is, and they're not going to consent to it. But in all cases, this is built on the English political tradition or the British political tradition going back to the Magna Charta. You have to have consent. Legislative powers, as Jefferson said, are incapable of annihilation. Why? Because the people have those powers and government does not have it because they exist. They only exist because people consent and say they exist. And that's a very important position that we need to understand. And that really is at the core of nullification. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show. Went through some nullification history, though, and some other ideas on philosophy. And I'll see you next time on episode 93. Have a good one.